Hi, everybody. I'm Charles Lane. I'm hosting this session today entitled The Living Earth and subtitled The Seven Spheres. And I did that intentionally since most of you are at least my age. And when you went to school, why we talked about the four spheres, and I figured this would be a grabber. So I intentionally entitled this The Seven Spheres. And decided we'd kind of take off and run with it from there. I'm, for those of you who are just in recently, professor of geology, actually chairman of the Department of Geology at a place called Hardin-Simmons University, which is in Abilene, Texas. And therefore, as a Lutheran, that makes me a lone voice crying out in the wilderness with a bunch of Southern Baptists. And that definitely has its moments, as a matter of fact. But I'm starting my second week. Last week I had a session on the geology of the Pacific Northwest, and we talked about volcanology and glaciology. And we're going to shift gears a little bit this week and talk about things on a much broader scale and with, I think, a little more substance in some respects. Before we do, though, I just kind of want to cast around the room and get a feel for where everybody is so that if you're from someplace obscure, we can find out about it and possibly use it in terms of making fun of you as we go through here.
New York City.
Yes, we have Californians, we have Washingtonians. Now, is there anybody besides Ann back here who is a Minnesotan?
No.
Well, we're going to have fun with you again today, Ann.
Minnesota,
I tell you. Where from?
California.
Indiana.
Colorado.
Where from?
Golden, Colorado.
Not a bad spot. Here's our Washingtonian connection.
Oregonians.
New York.
California.
Oklahoma.
Yes, and Oklahoma. We can have some fun with that.
Washington,
California. Where from?
North Hollywood, actually.
Okay. I know North Hollywood very well, as a matter of fact. I used to do a lot of work in North Hollywood, trying to build houses up in the Santa Monicas, as a matter of fact. And
Idaho.
Yes, and Idaho. Okay, well, we'll use that to best advantage. Ann already knows. I've picked on her a couple of times already in these kinds of sessions. Let me tell you what's going on this week. The week ends, basically, or the week's activities end with the 4th of July. And, of course, you'll all want to be around for the world-famous Holden fireworks display. Because it's, and I haven't seen it yet either, but I've been told about it, and it sounds like something quite unusual. But we're gonna end the week with the 4th of July celebration, and the Holden staff has made a decision that the 4th of July is going to be Interdependence Day rather than Independence Day, and asked us to approach all of our sessions this week from the perspective of interdependence. Could not have worked better for me in terms of what I'm going to be talking about this week. The things that I'm going to be talking about this week, for the most part, are based upon the musings of a wonderful author, Jonathan Weiner. Some of you have some experience with him already. He's a best-selling author before this book. The book that brought him a certain amount of national prominence was Planet Earth, which was turned into an 8 or 10 part PBS series that was successful a couple of years back. The book, which you can get over in the bookstore, is entitled The Next 100 Years, Shaping the Fate of Our Living Planet, and the inspiration for part of the title for this session. He is not a geologist, he is not an earth scientist, but he is a very clever writer that writes very well about earth science for general consumption. As a fascinating book, the quote behind me is taken from a chapter out of the book, and I liked it. If the Almighty had consulted me before embarking on the creation, I would have recommended something simpler. And that's where we're going to start today with the business of the seven spheres. I had put this globe up here in this particular fashion, waiting for the first person to comment on it. And we know who that was in terms of how unusual this looks. One of the things that I get a huge kick out of with my students is taking either a world map, or in particular, I find it's more effective when I take the map of North America and turn it upside down and hang it on the wall. And it is interesting to watch the discomfort that that creates among the students in the classroom. It's hard for them to look at that globe that way because everybody knows that this way is up. I hate to break the news to you, but on a cosmic scale, it can be just about any way you want. And putting it this way up kind of gives you a little different perspective on things. And, of course, one of the things that jumps out at me is just how much water there is when you put the southern hemisphere up. And there are lots of ramifications to that, a few being that there are entire ecosystems present in the northern hemisphere that simply do not exist in the southern hemisphere because the climates are so different because there is so much more water in the southern hemisphere. But I wanted to take a little bit of time today to talk about spheres in particular, because that's what scientists do and tend to do even more so now than in years past. Let's talk about spheres, because living on a sphere is unlike living on any other type of object. And there are certain things about living on a sphere and on a spinning sphere that are just kind of weird and kind of different. First of all, you guys have all seen globes, and you've all seen them sitting on the desktop, and they look like this. And if you're like me, one of the first things you did when you were a kid is you looked at that and said, why is that globe sitting like that instead of with the north and south poles straight up and down like that? Why is that? Why is that, Stanford? I caught her with her mouth full of peanuts, too.
Isn't it tilted that way? That's what makes the seasons and everything. It's tilted. I don't know why exactly the Earth is tilted like that, but I know that and if it was tilted just a little different, life couldn't exist on Earth because that affects the heating and cooling and how much sun hits the surface in which place and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, you've done a nice job of sort of dancing around the whole thing. What is it that it is tilted with respect to?
Which is fine.
Okay, who else?
God.
The plane of the solar system, which the astronomers refer to as the plane of the ecliptic. Basically, you can draw a horizontal plane right through the middle of the sun, and all the planets line up on it, most of them. We have a couple of them that are way out, and they tend to be way out. But we have this thing that we call the plane of the ecliptic, and we are tilted with respect to the plane. Okay. That was sort of subtle. But you're absolutely right. If we did not have that, as it turns out, 23.5 degree tilt, and the Earth were like this, with respect to the sun out here and the plane going right through the equator of the Earth, we would have no seasons. We would have no seasons. We wouldn't have the material for great novels either. You all know about the Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn. And you know that there is a Tropic of Capricorn, which is up here in this one, and the Tropic of Cancer, which is down here in this one. And, of course, that's the extent to which the sun migrates season to season, right? We just had the sun directly over the Tropic of Cancer back on June 21st. It was let's get back here and orient it for all of us Northern Hemisphere types. It was directly over the Tropic of Cancer, so the sun had made its northernmost swing. That's how we see it. It's a matter of basically how we're oriented with respect to the sun and its most direct rays hitting, not surprisingly enough, 23.5 degrees north of the equator. Other time of the year, the sun over here, most direct rays are 23.5 degrees south of the equator, Tropic of Capricorn. Okay, and the sun migrates back and forth between there. And were it not for that tilt, we would not have the seasons.
There's some change, isn't there? Isn't the Earth in an elliptical orbit?
There is a certain amount of change because of the nature of the Earth's elliptical orbit, and that's why we talk about perihelion and aphelion, closest and farthest points with respect to the sun. There are also...
So that makes some seasons, wouldn't it?
Well, the biggest change in seasons, the biggest change in seasons has to, if this is the sun.
Why are you saying that? I'm not saying that orbit would make some difference.
Not anywhere near as much as the orientation with respect to the tilt of the axis. Okay. Come on in. There are actually some orders of motion to the Earth spinning that also have an effect. But the other thing is the fact that we live on a spinning sphere, which rotates once every... Now let's try a little tougher question. So we have this rotational motion of once every 24 hours. And if I turn the Earth towards you like this and tell you it's a big circle and ask you to tell me how many degrees there are in a circle, and if you divide 360 by 24, she really didn't expect this. Every 15 degrees, of course, you jump a time zone, 24 time zones on the surface of the Earth. 24 time zones on the surface of the Earth. And 24 hours in the day. All fits very nicely. Okay? Now, just another brief excursion. Everybody remembers back from their school days about latitude and longitude, right? One of the things about being where we are is that we are more than 45 degrees latitude north of the equator. Equator is 0 degrees latitude. North Pole is 90 degrees latitude. If you say you're at 90 degrees north latitude, you don't even have to give a longitude. Right? It doesn't matter. It's hopeless at that point. Or for that matter, 90 degrees south latitude. And of course, longitude is a little tougher because you don't have the equator to work with. What's the baseline for longitude? Greenwich, England and the prime meridian. Okay, Greenwich, England, the prime meridian. And so we go, she's doing wonderfully, but she's a Stanford person. She's supposed to be very bright. You should get a copy of the tape as well. Take it home. You're as big a player in this discussion as anybody else. And, of course, then we talk about going in terms of degrees west of the prime meridian or east of the prime meridian. Use a way to find our way around. And, of course, this has been going on for a long time with respect to seafaring peoples trying to find their way around the world's oceans. You may be surprised that the formalization of time zones is a fairly recent development that is tied basically to the advent of instantaneous communications back in the late 1800s. And it had to do with a banker in New York sending a letter to a banker in San Francisco saying that when the cable, as in telegraph cable, system gets hooked up, well, I'm going to send you a cable at noon on such and such a day. And, of course, noon in New York is not noon in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it's actually late in the 1800s before the formalization of the time zones occurred. But nevertheless, time in the scope of human endeavors on the surface of the globe is kind of a weird deal. And that's why the prime meridian was put in Greenwich, England. Of course, if it's high noon on a Monday in Greenwich, England, and we go 12 hours this direction to the west, where are we, besides at the international dateline? Where are we time-wise? Not yet. We're going 12 hours this way. We're going toward midnight between Sunday and Monday, right? Because it's morning in the Americas, right? And of course, if we go 12 hours the other way, we are going toward midnight between Monday and Tuesday. And so out here in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, for a brief moment in time, Monday doesn't exist. That's because we live on a globe. That's because we live on a sphere. And we live on a spinning sphere. We didn't formalize that process of time until the 1880s, but Magellan's crew knew about it nearly 400 years before that. Magellan didn't ever make it back, but his crew did. When his crew got back, they and the Queen were off by a day. There was no international dateline, no prime meridian, no formalized time zones. Didn't have to be. It's a reality. You know, our tendency is to think, well, this is just a convention. This is a man-made convention that we have. And we formalize these time zones. But it's a reality of living on a spinning sphere. And the thing I'm trying to bring across to all of you with this is that all that we are due by living on this sphere really needs to be thought about and reflected upon with respect to a sphere and all the various intricacies that are involved in that. We're going to carry this theme over the next couple of sessions. I think the next one I've entitled Earth Circles and the third one I've entitled Earth Cycles. But it has to do with some of the really odd, unusual, and almost counterintuitive types of realities that come from living on a spinning sphere. So it's really kind of important to get us into a mindset of talking about everything that goes on in nature as being related to a sphere. Those of you who were in the university setting as a student in the mid to late 60s and the early 70s had experiences much like mine where with the first, shall we say, environmental awakening, we were talking about the four spheres. And that was by design. This is spaceship Earth, right? Remember that kind of terminology? This is spaceship Earth. And we're talking about the four spheres. We were talking about, first of all, the atmosphere. Nobody has a problem following that kind of a concept. We had talked about the hydrosphere, the Earth's waters, the waters of this sphere. We had talked about the lithosphere, which is litho for rock, so the Earth's crust, the lithosphere. And we talked about, in particular, the biosphere. Four spheres. And we had atmospheric chemists and physicists that would work in the atmosphere, and we had hydrologists of some kind, oceanographers working in the hydrosphere, and of course geologists and geophysicists and geochemists working in the lithosphere, biologists working in the biosphere, and the thing they had in common, I'll talk about being part of a sphere. This book, The Next 100 Years, formalizes, in a sense, a kind of consensus that is developing among scientists everywhere. And Wiener would suggest that virtually all scientists are Earth scientists, which suits me just fine from my own background. But he suggests that all scientists are Earth scientists because the interdependence of the spheres is staggering, and it's fascinating, and it's surprising, and it takes us on some amazing twists and turns. And we've found some things in the last 20 years that lead us to subdivide this just a little bit more, and hence the seven spheres. And so to this list, we would add, and I did this last week, we would add the term cryosphere. And for some of you who have been around, you know, this is the realm of ice. Fortunately, water in a solid state and water in a liquid state are two completely different things. And fortunately, water in a solid state is virtually unlike any other common thing that might change phase like that in our experience. And you folks have all known this all of your lives, but perhaps had never thought that much about it. Water is very weird when it turns to ice, because it actually occupies a greater volume as a solid than as a liquid. That's extraordinarily unusual. And yet, if that were not the case, life on Earth would not exist as we know it, because the ice forms on the top. It floats in the top of your glass of iced tea or ice water. It does not sink to the bottom. It sank to the bottom, chilled the next layer of water. If that happened on a global scale, we'd freeze the oceans, and the basis of all life as we know it would be gone. So water is ice is kind of important to us. It's important to folks who live in this part of the world because these North Cascade Mountains are sculpted by the ice. This fantastic scenery we have around here is sculpted by the actions of ice. In the last 20 years, it's become very important to scientists, not as a sculpting mechanism, but as a means of historical record. We have historians, we have New Testament scholars, people who look at books and other things to read the record. There is a record of Earth history contained in the ice fields of Greenland and the Antarctic ice cap that tell an absolutely fascinating story of atmospheric temperatures and gas concentrations, of solar energy, of all kinds of amazing things. And it's exploded over the last 20 years. So we're very interested in the cryosphere. We're also interested in what we call the sphere of, and I'll just abbreviate this. Also interested in what we call the sphere of fire. And by that, what I'm talking about is the activity of the sun upon the Earth's spheres, other spheres. And we'll touch a little bit more about this. I actually touched on some of this a little bit earlier. Talked about the little ice ages for historians that affected not only Europe, North America in the 13 and 1400s and froze the Baltic and gave us Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates and also drove the Pueblo dwellers of Mesa Verde out of their homes. But there's also the solar maximum that occurred back about the 11th century AD that, among other things, turned the northern end of Yorkshire, right? England, guys all know Yorkshire, it's kind of up a ways. That's James Herriot country, right? Turned the northern end of Yorkshire into the predominant grape-growing and wine-producing region of Europe. So we're sort of interested in the sphere of fire. And all of these are very scientific. And then sort of from a more, shall I say, sociological perspective, the sphere of human affairs. Use that term. The sphere of human affairs. And I expect to spend a fair amount of time during the course of the week talking about the sphere of human affairs as it ties to all of this. I want to take some time and kind of run through the nature of interdependencies among these spheres. And some of these things, after we kind of go through this, you'll say, gee, I knew that. And that's fine. You know, this is more a time of focusing some of our thinking. Okay, over in that corner, we have Anne from Duluth. You knew this was coming back to you, didn't you? We have Anne from Duluth. I'm not going to pick on you anymore, Dana-Lynn. I'm going to give you a rest.
Okay.
All right. Now, we're going to ask her to pretend that she's basically from Minneapolis-St. Paul, even though she wouldn't go there for love or money. Like a true Duluther, well, she has no use for the Twin
Duluthian.
Cities.
Duluthian.
All right. Well, this is good. I can see play on words coming up already. Anti-Duluthian. Not to be confused with anti-Diluvian. I like this. At any rate, talk to us about, let's talk about January in Minnesota.
Do we have?
All right, talk about January in Minnesota. And just typical January. Daytime high temperature, nighttime low temperature.
January. High
10, low 24. Low is real
low? 2 weeks out of January. Maybe then 20
and zero.
What?
That's just Duluth.
That's just Duluth, yeah.
Minneapolis, right?
Yeah. Right. 5 degrees.
5 and 15 there.
The official climatic data that I have for Minneapolis-St. Paul for January is that the average temperature for the month, and this is taken from the daytime highs, nighttime lows, going in between, is about 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So all you Southern Californians are ready to move there, right? In a big hurry. All right, let's pick on a Portlander, Seattle type. Who wants to volunteer for this one? You'll take it? All right. January temperatures, Portland, Seattle.
High might be 40. Low would be 34.
All right. Now, high 40, low 34. One thing that should jump out and grab you immediately is that the range of temperature between the daytime high and the nighttime low is dramatically less than being in Minnesota. And in fact, that's not hitting it too badly again, because the official Portland information I have is about 38 degrees would be the average temperature. Now, the thing of it is that latitudinally speaking, they're about the same place in terms of their distance north of the equator. So what's the difference?
The major difference is that there's nothing between North Pole and Minnesota except a couple of barbed wire fences.
That's like that t-shirt that says Duluth is not the end of the world, but you can see it from here.
We have lots of mountain ranges. But water is one thing, the major thing.
Water is the major thing.
Pacific Ocean.
The Pacific Ocean is sitting right there, and the world's oceans are the great moderator of climates. If you like narrow temperature ranges, all right, and a climate that's not so terribly hot nor so terribly cold, turn the globe upside down and start looking. Look at the amount of the world's oceans that are contained here in the southern hemisphere as compared to land masses. And the extreme differences in temperature that you get in inland areas in the northern hemisphere just disappear. Same latitude in terms of its distance north of the equator, but that's a big difference between 38 degrees Fahrenheit and 4 degrees Fahrenheit in terms of temperature. That's the interaction of the lithosphere, the land surface upon which we live, with the hydrosphere, the world's oceans. Let me take you on a trip to an even more extreme situation. And we'll start to get Solzhenitsyn-ish about it. There's a town in Siberia that none of us would want to visit. And I will butcher the pronunciation because my Russian is not all that great in this respect. But there's a town in Siberia, and it's out here, someplace about here. Looks like one of the world's garden spots.
Green.
Yes, it was green. The town is Verkhoyansk, in the USSR. It has an infamous distinction. It has an infamous distinction.
Verkhoyansk has recorded a high temperature as high as 91 degrees Fahrenheit. Warm enough. It'd be a warm day in Seattle, right?
It has recorded a low temperature of minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit. You add those things together, and that is a 181 temperature range. If you live in San Diego, you may see 95 on a hot day. You may see 35 on a cold winter night. That is a 60 degree temperature range. That is a third of what that temperature range is. The physical geographers have a term for it. They call it continentality, property of being like a continent. But the point is that when you are in this enormous landmass, the moderating effects of the hydrosphere do not exist. In fact, there is another town, Russian town, begins with a V. It's called Vagach, which is up here on the Arctic Ocean. During the winter, people from Verkhoyansk go there to warm up. They go. Think of it, going to the Arctic Ocean in the winter to warm up and take a vacation. But they're here in the midst of this enormous landmass and going to the Arctic Ocean, even though it may be pretty much frozen up, is going to give them basically warmer weather and a warmer time. And it is something like 10 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit warmer on the Arctic coast than it is inland. So there is this influence of the hydrosphere on the lithosphere. It's incredible. It's incredibly pronounced. But once you're here in this part of the world, and you start talking about ice, I erased it, cryosphere, when you start talking about ice in the Arctic Ocean, then you throw in yet another variable into the equation. Now, the thing about the Arctic Ocean that makes it dramatically different than Antarctica is that the Antarctic ice sheet is in fact on top of a landmass, top of a continent. The Arctic ice sheet is basically floating on top of the water. And this is another piece of trivia that fascinates me. You'll have to make your own decision as to what it does for you. But the annual temperature, all right, so the annual temperature in this place, and take all the monthly temperatures and add them up by month 12, the annual temperature at the North Pole is 21 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is at the South Pole. That's the same thing as the annual temperature difference between New York City and Miami. Who'd have thought? But what happens here in the Arctic, of course you get the spring thaws and the fall freezes of the ice. Freezes, sort of like on the other end when you have the water evaporate in the atmosphere, the freezes force the salt out of the water, or force the salt out of the ice, right? So the more the ice freezes, the more salt is forced out. The more salt that's left in the water below the ice, now we're back to that business about ice floating on top, the more salt that you have now forced down below the ice cap makes the water just below the ice denser. That denser water sinks to the bottom of the Arctic. And to a lesser extent, same kind of thing happens on the ice shelves off the Antarctic continent over water. But that heavier, saltier water sinks to the bottom. It turns the ocean over in much the same way that lakes and ponds will turn over. And it brings up all of those nutrients which feed the krill, which in turn feed everything else all the way up the world's food chains.
And so now we've thrown in the cryosphere and the biosphere. And a very tight linkage. And a very tight linkage. Right. Okay, now.
May I speak to something here in the Puget Sound?
Sure.
Variable. That's, I think it's unusual, and I don't understand it completely. We're in a convergence zone, and on the island, and in and around Everett, and south to some extent, mostly north of Everett, we have microclimates, and they'll vary. The gentleman mentioned 30 to, well, I've forgotten the range that you suggested.
40 to 34.
On the island, we have 21 to 35. There are times when we left Everett on the mainland, snowing, got to the ferry about 5 miles away, it had stopped, crossed over, the sun was shining, about 10 miles on the north on the island, snowing again, and then rain in between.
It's times when we cancel meetings at our end of the island because it's snowing so hard, and our friends halfway up or north think we're doing it just to avoid them because they're in sunshine.
We have air currents that literally are blowing in all directions at the same time in the same place.
That's why I'm glad you didn't ask us about our average.
About your average temperature. Mm-hmm. The thing about hilly and mountainous areas is that the microclimates you create are really amazing, and the variability you can attain is amazing. Back in my days when I was teaching at California Lutheran, I would take a January term class to the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Now, the rim of the Grand Canyon in January is something to behold because it may have 3 or 4 or 5 feet of snow and it may be 20 below. But the very bottom of the Grand Canyon in January may be 40 or 50 or 60 degrees with the sunshine, and it's an absolutely marvelous time to go in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And you have differences in climate due to that great depth, differences due to being on a north slope, south slope. If you look at this side of Railroad Valley and see all of these trees, and you look at Miner's Ridge over here on this side, it's a dramatic difference. If you want to see a really dramatic difference, stand on the Pacific Crest Trail in the Sierra Nevada of California and look at those forests on the west side and look at that desert that's on the east side at exactly the same elevation. And so the microclimates that are created by the up and down are something to behold. And so I can believe that that's the case. Let me press on to something that is going to tie a little more directly to some of the rest of the stuff that we're going to work on this week. And that's a relationship between the biosphere and the atmosphere. And let me throw a couple of things at you that were kind of staggering to me. This is a staggering number here, this temperature range. I'm trying to prepare your house to tolerate a 181 degree temperature shift. Talk a little bit about photosynthesis and respiration. Here's a couple numbers for you. Every year, all of us, all animal life, and also plant life, as a matter of fact, we kind of tend to think of plant life as a one-way street in this respect, but it's not. It's just a rate function. But animal life and plant life will put 100 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. Every year, every one of us, all other living animals, and plants as well, will put 100 billion tons of carbon into the air. Now, you don't think about that so much because you're thinking,
Yeah, I breathe oxygen in and I breathe carbon dioxide out. Carbon dioxide has carbon in it. Right? You put 100 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere, and if all goes according to plan, 100 billion tons of carbon get taken up by plants. The dynamic equilibrium between the biosphere and the atmosphere. Oh, you're just stretching your yarn. Dynamic equilibrium between the biosphere and the atmosphere. There are approximately 700 billion tons of carbon in the Earth's atmosphere at any one point in time. So this thing cycles through every 7 years. Okay. We're going to come back to this. We're going to come back to this because in some future sessions we'll talk a little bit about what controls photosynthesis and what controls respiration. Because this is our dynamic equilibrium right here. 100 in, 100 out. 100 in, 100 out. It is an interaction of extraordinary importance to all of us between the biosphere and the atmosphere. Again, interaction, interdependence. I'm going to leave that there. I'm going to leave that point there for just a minute, kind of move on to something else, but keep this firmly in mind. Interdependence, interrelationship between biosphere and atmosphere. Right? And move on to a couple of other points that hopefully I'll have time to make. Okay. Covering all the spheres, the sphere of fire, okay, the sun's activities, 5,000 BC. You don't go back that far, do you, Ted? That's
before I was born.
I was thinking more about your studies, but you're going to do mostly New Testament stuff. This is going back a little bit farther. 5,000 BC has a certain amount of significance to the history of the human race, because it's approximately this point in time that you saw the rise, the advent of Chinese civilization.
Hey, hooray. It's about time.
That you saw the advent of Sumerian civilization. Minoan civilization, in essence, the rise of civilization, about 5,000 BC. This is also a time that you saw solar maximum. You saw solar maximum. In other words, the warming effects of the sun were greater at this point in time. It's also tied closely to what glaciologists talk about as the altothermal, highest temperature. Talking about after the last ice age, this was the highest temperature recorded on the planet. And then temperatures had turned back around and started going back down until recently. Okay. But an altothermal event tied to what's called a solar maximum, that's what the astronomers refer to it as. And I've also already pointed out to you the 1000 or so AD was another solar maximum that basically turned England into the greatest wine producing country in Europe and took that on our way from the French, as a matter of fact. Of course, the other side of that was the solar minimum that followed early in the 1300s and gave us the little ice ages that I've talked about before. Little ice ages that so dramatically affected Europe and
also civilizations of indigenous North American peoples as well. And so here we have a profound effect upon the people of the time. This even lasted long enough to affect people through the 1400s. And there was even some lingering effects of the Little Ice Ages into the early 1700s through the winter of 1711-1712 when the River Thames froze over for the last time. It's the last recorded period of time that the River Thames froze over. Of course, that took you into another sphere that was shortly to have an impact. And, all right, so if we treat all of this as the sphere of fire, should I say back to another one of the spheres, back to the lithosphere again. The year was actually 1816. And in 1815, is this ringing bells for you? Or you?
I was about to just ask about the winter of 1815. And the summer of that year, when there was no summer.
This is exactly where we're heading.
It was the volcano.
This was something that's called Mount Tambora. It was a volcano that blew up in Indonesia. Many of you Northwestern types are survivors of Mount St. Helens, shall we say. And in May of 1980, when St. Helens blew up, it ejected approximately 1 cubic kilometer of material into the air. And it had an effect. It had an effect on all those poor souls that live in Yakima, where 600,000 tons of ash fell basically within the city limits. And of course, you were getting the stuff all over Idaho and Montana and even points farther east. And 1 cubic kilometer of material ejected from St. Helens. Mount Tambora blew up in 1815 and ejected over 40 cubic kilometers of material into the atmosphere. In 1816, there was the year without a summer. In June of 1816, there were frosts throughout New England. In June of 1816, down into Maryland, Thomas Jefferson had his crops fail and had to apply for a loan to tide him through. And I forget the author, but there's a rather famous book that actually has that title, The Year Without a Summer, 1816, The Year Without a Summer. And it was a result of Tambora exploding. Indonesia also gave us Krakatau in 1883, which, with somewhat more sophisticated temperature recording devices, we were able to ascertain that global temperatures were depressed for approximately 10 years as a result of Krakatau. Did not have quite the sophisticated instrumentation to do that with Tambora, but we're able to do that with Krakatau. And so there's this interdependence of the spheres. There is this colossal continuing process of interdependence of the spheres that goes on in enormous and in some cases mysterious ways, and some things that we don't know about yet, I'm sure, without a whole lot of input on our part. And yet there is input on our part into all of the spheres of the planet, and with dramatic effect. What I hope to explore a little further as we go through the session this week is just the extent of that, what that means, in some respects, how we came to get here. I'm going to do that by going through what I've called the Earth Circles next session, Earth Cycles after that, and then wind up talking about, I believe the fourth session is entitled CO2, the Master Switch, and the last session is the Third Millennium. Now, you need to be here for that. This isn't apocryphal and biblical. I don't know what is. But there is a fantastic interdependence, and you know, I've tried to point out a few of them that now that you kind of sit back and reflect upon, you were sort of aware of this all along, but maybe not in any sort of formalized, structured fashion. But there is this interdependence, and there are some very tricky aspects to the nature of these interdependencies because of the fact that we live on a rotating sphere. And it's become very important to scientists and the scientific community in the last 20 years to get in a mindset of thinking about it by thinking about spheres. So we talk about spheres of influence in political circles, this sort of stuff. Well, there's a great reason for getting in that mindset, because living on this spinning sphere in space carries with it some really intricate, interesting types of realities. And we have to be able to address those realities and think in terms of those kinds of realities if we are going to fully understand what we're about here. So that's kind of where I wanted to take us. It's 4:56. Let's let fly with anybody who wants to try something.
Is there a curiosity? You mentioned that the Mount St. Helens was 1 kilometer. What was Pinatubo last year?
Pinatubo? I have not heard the figures on that, but I think it was well in excess by the time all the eruptions were over of what St. Helens was.
It's influenced the weather.
Yes, and of course we've had fabulous sunsets ever since. We've had magnificent sunsets because of Pinatubo. But I believe that the total volume was in excess of what St. Helens was.
What would be the lapse of time, say, for its total influence?
Some of this would be much quicker than what you might imagine. If I recall correctly, detection of some of the particulate matter that Pinatubo put out around the globe, in other words, time for it to go around the globe, was accomplished within the span of something like 40 to 50 hours. Mm-hmm. Extraordinarily quickly. Mm-hmm. That's a function of how high you get it. You get it up into the jet stream and you have a good jet stream working. Why? It can be very fast.
And the consensus seemed to be that for that reason there would be less effect, total effect, like the 1815, 1816.
Well, the Tamboro eruption was an enormous eruption. I think it was just the sheer volume of material that was released all at once that had the greatest effect, because it got very high in the air. It got very high in the air. Yes?
Do you know if the predictions came true that the increased risk of skin cancer has been increased quite a bit over the northern part of this country this last winter?
The stuff I've read is that, what you do is, of course, equate the incidences of skin cancer to the size of ozone hole. Okay? And the stuff I've read indicates that this last winter has been a very bad one in terms of the size of the ozone hole over the Arctic, be very large.
Well, we're up in Campbell River just in Memorial Day.
Maybe say a few words about the oil fires in Kuwait and why the predictions on the changes in the weather that would cause were so, at least apparently, not as bad as predicted. Or maybe they're worse than we don't know.
Well, and of course, you know, there's a whole lot of things that enter into that. One is what what is the, in essence, the window of opportunity? I mean, have we seen everything that that there is to be seen from that? One of the things is that that Arabian sweet light oil burns much cleaner than a lot of stuff that you have in this country, and so I think that was one of the contributing factors, at least in terms of being seeing big black oily clouds going around, did not show up as well as everybody thought it would. The other thing, though, and I think one of the days this week talk a little bit about it, there is nothing in the physical sciences that is as difficult as modeling global circulation patterns. I don't know how many of you have at least read the popular literature on mathematics, but the chaos theory stuff and the nonlinear equations are things that you have to work with, and they're characterized by their non-predictive nature, in a sense. And so it's very, very difficult to do much with that. That question really reflects where the cutting edge is in atmospheric research now, is on how we can best model all these swirls and eddies, which is actually a big part of what I tend to talk about tomorrow. I'm going to talk about the weather map. I'm going to talk about things swirling around, going in circles and eddies, and why that is, because it's kind of a fascinating story in and of itself. I don't know if I answered your question very well.
Charles, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Could I ask for a short commercial if there is somebody here that would be willing to let me suggest this young lady here is Carla Birkendahl. She is the director of the Episcopal Church Earth Ministry, a new organization formed. And the reason I brought it up is, speaking of interdependency, this is a great deal of what this is all about. Do you care to say anything, Carla?
Well, that's putting her on the spot worse than I would have.
Except I'm looking forward to talking to you, and it's always fun to be at Holden because there's so many people for whom theology and the sciences and environment are all spinning together. So it's just always a pleasure to be here.
Tremendous resource, maybe, for us.
Yeah.
And I will, I'll be happy to send my wife off to reserve a spot at the table for me and chat for a few minutes.
Not this year, no.
Thanks a bunch, folks.
Yes.
You're so inclined, you would get more.